Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Another week of Financial Literacy Month. Hooray for that. To start, we're highlighting ABC Life Literacy Canada. Their Money Mentors program helps Canadians learn the basics when it comes to money management. Executive Director Allison Howard is here to talk about that program and share her financial literacy tips. Then the last thing you want to worry about before traveling is your financial security, but there are risks that you should be aware of before you head out on your journey. Nora Dunn is a digital nomad and personal finance expert at NerdWallet. She's here to share some tips on how you can minimize those risks. And if you're faced with a critical illness, the medical expenses and the bills can be a lot of added stress to an already difficult situation. Critical illness insurance may be able to help. There are pros, but it all comes at a cost. PolicyMe has launched its own critical insurance product, and we're going to talk to the company's founder and COO, Laura McKay. A digital real estate platform called YE, CEO Benj Katchen, talks about how it works and whether this one is going to be successful at disrupting the real estate sector. Plus, building awareness around a very tough topic, economic abuse. Meseret Haliasis is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Women's Empowerment, and we're going to talk about what that phrase refers to and what can be done to address it. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. You are used to fun, frothy news you can use to help you get a better handle on your money. We're going to begin today's show with something a little different in terms of tone and in terms of topic. And it's important. So stay with me here. Awareness around different kinds of abuse is really important. Awareness is such an important first step. One kind that is not often talked about, though, is economic abuse. What does the phrase mean? Who does it affect? And what can be done about it? Meseret Haliasis is the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Women's Empowerment. She joins us now from Ottawa to talk about it. Hello there.
Hello.
What do you mean when you use the phrase economic abuse?
Thank you so much for inviting me. So economic abuse is it's a form of family violence or gender-based violence, which is underreported, underrecognized, and such a just form of violence that often accompanied by, you know, other form of abuse, including physical, psychological, and emotional abuse. So economic abuse is a very complex because there's emotion, there's a physical violence, and also other form of violence also included. But there are some signs, the way it manifests, for example, like it happens, you know, when domestic partner interferes, access to finance, of their partner, and sometimes when also the perpetrator or abuser, you know, prohibits the victims to use a credit card, writing check, accessing, you know, marital account, preventing the victim career advancement, and sabotaging also employment is also a tactic of, you know, economic abuse. As I said, it's very broad. It also includes some of the economic resource, so which is including controlling, you know, using phone. Phone is also a communication. Accessing transportation services. Refuse to control, to contribute costs for child support. Even sometimes generates, you know, financial costs without consent, such as like, you know, fraudulently racking up a credit card, you know, date in the partner names. It, you know, it's a lot of things are like.
For whom is this, who is the most vulnerable to economic abuse? Because when we think about, you know, physical abuse for women in relationships, I know, and the data would say that that can present in households far and wide and at all levels of the income environment in this country. When it comes to economic abuse, is it clustered towards particular income groups, or what have you learned on that front?
So from our even research and from our day-to-day work, you know, this is a hidden form of violence. It affects everyone, with regardless of your social class. But women who come from, like, you know, Black, Indigenous, and, you know, gender diverse community, newcomers, refugees, they are highly impacted by financial and economic abuse because of the systemic barrier. And also, we believe that economic abuse is a systemic problem in our society, which we are severely lacking the infrastructure to address.
When you say it's systematic, what do you mean?
Yeah, so one of the challenges for survivors of gender-based violence to leave the abusive relationship is, you know, accessing, you know, economic resource. So in this situation, perpetrators deliberately women finance. So finance would be the critical barrier to leave that situation. So unfortunately, we don't have a very strong systems and policy and then program in our financial institution. So what we have seen is when a woman, you know, if facing such form of violence, they prefer to run to the bank or, you know, any financial institution to access those kind of services. So what we heard even recently, some of our financial institutions, they don't have a trauma-informed, violence-informed, even customer care. So this is one of the systemic barriers. The other is, like, you know, many women who have gone through such form of violence, they don't have a good credit. Their credit is destroyed by the perpetrator, so it's very hard for them to secure an apartment. As you know, in Ontario, if I want to have, like, any kind of, like, you know, asset or even going back to school, you know, you have to pay your registration fee on credit card. So many women, they don't have that access because their credit is destroyed. They are not eligible for, you know, to go back to school, to go back to even the workforce, and even to get the housing, because the requirement even to get the housing, you should have cosigner, you should have deposit sometimes. And, you know, women are out of, you know, from, you know, any support. So this is a systemic barrier. And the other systemic barrier is, like, you know, accessing, like, phone, transportation, you know, like, for example, you have a phone services, and if you don't pay for 2-3 months, you know, the phone companies, they will terminate, you know, your phone service. Phone is also one of the economic resources for a woman to communicate, to talk to her doctor, to talk to the social worker. So in this case as well, women will be trapped because this has a systemic issue every woman they face. And then even to eligible also for social services, there's a lot of requirements. So many women, they are not qualified. For example, if you have a joint asset, let's say in Saskatoon or in Saskatchewan, and you live in Ontario, but still you have an asset with your abuser. So when you come to another province, you are not eligible to get even housing. It's very, very complicated, you know? So it's a lot of systemic issues that women, like, you know, keep them, like, you know, not to even generate their income and then not to survive and recover from this kind of violence.
What are some of the signs that people in the helping professions, friends and family, people in the community, what could they have their eye open for? And I know it is so oversimplified to be, you know, watching for signs of physical abuse in partnerships, but I can imagine it's even more difficult to discern what's going on when it comes to economic abuse, because there's not going to be a bruise, a physical bruise on your face.
Yeah, you're right. You know, this is a multi-layered, you know,
this kind of thing, a multi-layered, you know, intervention, you know. Yeah, I totally agree, specifically for service providers. Definitely, we need to ask the woman financial situation, which is very important, especially before they leave abusive situation. We need to educate women on how they could protect, like, you know, their password, electronic signature. These are the most frequently, you know, asked, you know, issues actually by many even professionals. So these are the most important thing we need to ask them. And also, it's good also to teach women, like, you know, what are the healthy and then unhealthy financial relationship. If someone puts you in date, you have to make sure that, like, if that is, like, you know, the date you signed, paper has to be, like, you know, you should have the awareness. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of fraudulent activities also done behind the scene. And the other things also, if someone's kind of, like, you know, goes through with kind of, like, you know, financial struggle, specifically in a violent situation, that's also red flag. So we need to check and we need to ask them, you know, how do they save? How do they have also any financial literacy skill? I think those are the most important things to protect women. Yeah.
Very briefly, I'm afraid we're out of time. Very briefly before we go, if you had to choose one call to action, what would it be?
So my call to action to end economic abuse across Canada, definitely more than ever, policymakers and advocates, private stakeholders, they have to come together and then address this issue. This issue is not only a social service issue or government issue. This is a business issue. We talk about economy, all about business. So I would like to, you know, ask all leaders, specifically leaders among financial institutions, hydro and then electronic companies, those agencies who provide also other services like essential service for a woman, they should have a plan and policy and a program as well for survivors of gender-based violence. So these are the most important thing. And we learned it also from many other countries. By doing this, they just made, you know, a huge change.
Meseret, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Meseret Haliousis is the executive director of the Canadian Center for Women's Empowerment. The focus of our conversation today is a phrase we don't talk a lot about, economic abuse.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I am going to live until I am 93 years old, and then I am going to die peacefully in my sleep, having watched Ted Lasso one last time. Right? That's how it's going to go? Okay, not likely. Not likely, right? Who knows how I'm going to go? Who knows what sort of illnesses I might suffer before I go? And same for you. You and I could be one of the millions of Canadians who are faced with a critical illness. And when you're going through such a difficult time in your life, it can be a huge challenge to deal with the illness, plus all of the financial consequences of the illness. This is why some Canadians choose to buy critical illness insurance. PolicyMe recently launched its own product, and joining us now is its co-founder and COO, Laura McKay, to talk about what it is and how it works. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me on today.
What is critical illness insurance?
Good question. Critical illness basically pays out a lump sum cash benefit, similar to life insurance, if for everyone who's familiar with that product. But instead of that coming if you were to pass away, you actually get the cash benefit if you become ill during the time that you're covered with the product. So this can include illnesses such as heart attack, stroke, cancer, some of the major illnesses that affect Canadians.
How does this fit with disability coverage? So some people have disability coverage either at work or they buy a separate policy. And do you have one or the other? Or if you're rolling in cash, do you get both?
Definitely. This is not intended to replace disability coverage. The intent of this is to go towards income, kind of expenses like out-of-pocket medical expenses. If you were to get diagnosed with one of the illness that are covered, it kind of goes hand in hand with disability coverage. It is above and beyond that because it takes on some of those additional expenses like caregiving expenses or childcare expenses that may not be covered by the disability payments if you were just replacing your income during that time.
Life insurance is very simple compared to critical illness in that if you pass away and you have the coverage, there's going to be a payout. I'm simplifying, but that's basically how it works. With critical illness, there's criteria and there's, you know, people who are coming in to assess the diagnosis and whether or not it fits within the policy that you have purchased. What are some of the nuances that people should understand? What is deemed to be a critical illness under this policy and what is not?
Definitely is a more complicated product than life insurance. So it's good to do your research when you're shopping around. Typically, the things you're going to want to look for is just the number of critical illness that the kind of diagnoses that can be covered by your policy. These have a huge spectrum in the Canadian market. There's some policies that only cover 4 with very strict definitions, and then there's some that cover up to 44, like ours, that are much more generous in kind of the amount of conditions that are covered. So if you're looking for very comprehensive coverage, you're probably going to want to shop around based on the number of conditions covered. Beyond that, every policy contract is going to have specific definitions for each condition. These are kind of legal, are kind of like legal language. So it may be difficult to interpret, but all you have to know is most of the covered conditions that are covered are going to have very similar definitions across insurers. So you can be fairly confident if something like early stage breast cancer is covered with one insurer, that the definition isn't going to be completely different than another insurer. So you're really going to look at the number of covered conditions as your way to compare products.
Where it gets me in my mind is, okay, cancer, got it. Okay, that makes sense. Got it. What about illnesses that are degenerative in nature? So something like multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, ALS, how they unfold is very particular to the individual. Some can ravage a human's life in a very short period of time. Some can be managed. The symptoms can be mitigated for decades.
So you're going to want to, if you have a family history of some of those conditions, you're probably going to want to look at a sample policy contract and just get comfortable with the definition that's stated there. Typically, critical illness insurance is looking for fairly severe, kind of like higher severity conditions or diagnoses. So it's hard to kind of say on every specific illness how it's defined, but it would be on the more severe spectrum that's going to be covered.
What's the vetting that happens? So you mentioned family history. If you have a family history of cancer, does that simply increase the policy cost, or could that exclude you?
Both can happen. I would say likely it would probably just increase the policy cost. Our approval rates for critical illness are very similar to a life insurance policy. So we don't see a broad difference between those two, like the underwriting criteria for both of the products. So most people who are going to be approved for their life policy would likely also be approved for a critical illness policy. You could have a slightly higher price if you do have quite a bit of family history of a certain illness, but those are all things you could kind of just apply online, get an answer for yourself, and be better equipped to make that decision once you are approved.
Without any specifics of an individual circumstance, what's the range for what one would expect to pay per month for a critical illness policy? Because we know, you know, like disability, let's call it $200 for income replacement, $300 for income replacement of $5,000. Tenant insurance is, you know, $30 a month. What's the range on critical? Not the range. What's a number that you would just plant that we could anchor to? Like, it's around that.
Typically, when you're thinking about coverage amount, a good rule of thumb can be around, you know, about 6 times your post-tax income. So for people, they might be looking around kind of like $25,000 to $50,000 of critical illness insurance. For someone who's in their 30s and 40s, that could be as affordable as like $15 a month, like going up to maybe $50 a month, but it's certainly nothing in the range of disability insurance where that can get quite expensive quite quickly.
What are the cons? So you did not lead with this policy. This was not the first thing that you decided to offer. I'm sure you had to be very thoughtful in terms of when you would add it onto your product shelf. Mm-hmm. What are some cons? I mean, certainly the one that I have heard of is how restrictive it can be, and how you know, getting the compensation can be very, very difficult. But what are some of the cons of this type of policy?
I actually think critical illness sometimes can be quite oversold by advisors in the market. So it's important to understand if you really need it. So one, if you have disability insurance in place, you're really not looking at using this policy to replace your income. You're going to be using it for extras, like in the form of out-of-pocket medical advance expenses. In Canada, a lot of those are going to be covered by OHIP. We're lucky to have such strong kind of public healthcare system. So I don't think when people are introducing this product, you should be thinking in the order of magnitude of like $100,000 or $200,000 of critical illness insurance. You want something that you can feel comfortable when you get diagnosed, that you have a kind of some money set to the side to cover those extras, but you don't want to overprotect yourself. So I would say that's one con for sure. The second is you don't want this to come before other financial priorities. So definitely I would say if you don't have life insurance, start with that. If you're not covered with disability insurance through your employer, you're definitely going to want to start with that. This would likely come after that. And even after perhaps like putting together a bit of an emergency savings fund for other kind of unexpected events that could happen to you and that you want to be protected against.
What are some things that you would say about a family's circumstance that would be either a pro or a con to pursuing critical illness? And I say that because, you know, life insurance, if you're a senior with no dependents, not even a senior, if you're a human with no dependents, probably doesn't make as much sense as it does if you're a parent to toddlers. What are the family dynamics that you would roll into it in terms of whether or not to get it and how much you get?
Like you pointed out, life insurance is definitely aimed towards people who have dependents. I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case with critical illness. Perhaps if you aren't surrounded by family members who could support you through like some caregiving, you may actually be in a bigger need for critical illness than those who have a lot of kind of close dependence. So I would say definitely if you feel as though you may need extra kind of childcare coverage or caregiving coverage, if you were to be diagnosed with a critical illness, that's when you definitely want to think about getting this product. Separately, if you do have kind of a family history that you're concerned about and you want to and definitely want to kind of have something in place in case that diagnosis comes to you, that would be another case where you may be interested in this product.
Interesting. Laura, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
Laura McKay is the co-founder and COO of PolicyMe, and the focus of our conversation was critical insurance, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, whether it makes sense for you. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll talk to Allison Howard, the executive director of ABC Life Literacy Canada. She is going to talk about a program called Money Matters, which focuses on financial literacy at a foundational level. Later, I'll speak to Benj Katchen, CEO of Wahi, about this digital real estate platform that aims to shake things up a little bit. I've heard that claim before. We'll see if he can deliver on that. For more Moolala, you can go to moolala.ca, and on that site, you can listen to past episodes. You can search for segments by a guest name, by topic, like critical insurance or insurance. You can listen to all the conversations we've had about insurance. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there where you download any podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever you listen to your podcast. You can download the full show. You can download segments. You could write a review. That'd be good. Or you could subscribe to the show so the next episode will just arrive ready and waiting for you.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. it starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Obviously, during Financial Literacy Month, we're going to talk about the importance of basic financial literacy. It's kind of critical. One organization that has been working on this task for a long time is ABC Life Literacy Canada. And they've got a whole bunch of ways that they endeavor to help teach Canadians the basic skills to make smarter decisions about money. One of the things that they do is a program called the Money Matters Program. And we've talked about it on the show before, but the world looks a whole lot different since the last time we focused on it. Plus, there's a new executive director in town. Allison Howard joins us now to talk about Money Matters and other ways in which Canadians can improve financial literacy. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
It has been an extraordinary couple of years. How has ABC Life Literacy reacted to this new world that we are now officially in terms of virtual learning and real uncertainty from a financial perspective for so many millions of Canadians?
Well, there are lots of things that we've been doing to accommodate all of the changes in the world. One of those is to move many of our materials online. So, for example, with the Money Matters program, we have workbooks that are available for free for everyone. And we have moved quite a few of them onto our online learning platform, which is abcskillshub.ca. Mm-hmm. Many other topics covered there too, of course. But we have lots of different materials available. They're all written in clear language, very accessible, all for free.
Tell me about Money Matters. It's obviously a really, really important part of the work that you do. Give me the who, what, when, where, why, and how of it.
Absolutely. So Money Matters is a free introductory financial literacy program that's designed particularly for adult learners, and it helps them build their confidence and reduce anxiety around managing their money. This is a program that we've been delivering to Canadians since 2011. Mm-hmm. So far, we've reached over 80,000 adults. Wow. We have support right from the start from our founding sponsor, TD Bank Group. And we get lots of great support from TD along the way. Their employees also volunteer with the program to deliver our Money Matters workshops right across the country.
What does it look like for a learner? Is it 15 modules? Are there quizzes? Are there videos? What's the learning experience?
Lots of different things. We have downloadable resources. We have brief workbooks. There are lots of videos, and we do have in-person and online workshops available as well. They're all standalone pieces. So you can go in, pick out one piece, a workbook, go through it, put it down, come back to it later. It's really up to you. It's very adaptable, and it's at your own pace. If you're looking at the materials online, it's in the comfort at home, absolute privacy, because that's another issue here too, isn't it? As adults, we're expected to just know automatically how to manage money. And it's a very personal thing, and it's not always easy to ask for help around that. So that's one advantage of visiting these kinds of materials online. You can do them at your own pace and in the privacy of your own home.
You can binge an 8-episode series on Netflix in just under 8 hours. If you were to binge the Money Matters online program, how long would it take? I know. I love how I worked in a Netflix
time,
reference
isn't...
here. Yeah, but I'm a type A kind of person. I'm like, all right, I'm going to do this Money Matters program. What am I signing up for?
You could do the whole thing in less than that. Depends on your comfort level with the reading material and how fast you want to go through it. And if you have the time to actually sit down and go through it all at once. Many, many different topics such as spending plans, banking basics, ways to save, smart shopping. So there's really something for everyone at date of life too.
Speaking of something for everyone, one of the things that I have long admired ABC for is the way you provide a layer of nuance for different communities to account for different circumstances and different lived experiences. Tell us a bit about some of those programs in particular.
Yes, so we do try to create materials that people can relate to. So we do have materials for people with diverse abilities. We look at newcomers to Canada. We look at many different population groups and try to target their needs and the questions that they have around these kinds of topics. And we do customize our materials for lots of different populations.
Now, there is a broad population that is tuning in to TikTok for everything, including financial literacy. I am deeply ambivalent about some of this content. I love that it's playful and fun and attracting a new audience, and some of it makes my jaw drop with the inaccuracies or the mischaracterizations of what it takes to be successful. How do you think about social media content?
Well, if it gets people interested and talking about it and motivated to learn more, it's great. As a source of trusted information, you might want to expand your opportunities there to look for something that is created with adult learners in mind, that's created by educators, and has that approachable the reading levels, the financial terminology, everything there that you can trust. That's a big piece of this.
You are new-ish in your role, not completely new. I assume you know where, you know, the key is to your office and how to spell the name of your payroll person. If you look ahead 5 years down the road, what are some things as it relates to financial literacy that you will be tremendously proud that ABC Life Literacy has accomplished?
So looking ahead to create even more customized materials for different population groups, creating materials in more languages, that is something that we also offer, our materials in many different languages. So expanding on that and creating more opportunities for in-person learning across the country, being able to get into those communities that we're not there yet or that we don't have as strong a presence as we do elsewhere, perhaps in the larger municipalities. So creating more opportunities for learning, whether that's in person and online, and to address more of the different population groups that we know are looking for help. Those are areas that we're really looking forward to addressing in the future.
Clearly, we are on the same team. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Allison Howard is the Executive Director of ABC Life Literacy Canada, and she was here to talk about their Money Matters program, among many other things.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, Benji Katchen from WAHI talks real estate. But first, how to protect yourself from financial security risks when you're traveling. And a note, while you're traveling, you can still check your email, right? So you could still read our newsletter. It is once a month. It is a summary and links to things that we have done on this radio show on Sirius XM, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, on wherever else we happen to be yapping along. So sign up for that at moolala.ca. Comes once a month. We won't do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Okay, I'll admit, traveling can be riskier than staying at home in your PJs watching Netflix on your couch. So worth it, though. In addition to the risk of a medical issue when you travel, it can happen. There can also be some risks to your financial security. So, what can you do to protect yourself and your money? Nora Dunn is NerdWallet's financial expert. She is a digital nomad herself, and she's here to share some tips on so you can worry a little less on your next trip. Hello there.
Hey, hey, Bruce. And hopefully by the end of this, we will be able to arm everybody with all the tools necessary to not only prepare and protect themselves, but to make sure that nothing bad happens on their next
trip.
Yes,
yes. What are some of the things at the top of your list? Some of the risks that people face, maybe that they don't even know they face.
Travel inherently subjects us to three different types of risk simultaneously, which is not something that would happen when we're at home. Those risks specifically are loss, damage, and theft. And of course, they're heightened when you travel because, for example, you're packing up all your stuff, you're taking it to different places, you're often out of your comfort zone, and in some cases, you will stand out as a tourist and thus a target. But these three risks of loss, damage, and theft aren't just physical. Yes, you could have your actual stuff stolen, but what we're talking today are the financial risks therein. So for example, if you lose a credit or debit card, that can put you in a financial bind if you haven't set up the right systems to deal with that if that happens on the road. Mm. And theft as well, like if you have a pickpocket that takes your wallet or even the theft of your identity, which is a big one, that can ruin an otherwise amazing trip.
What are some things that people can do to reduce the consequences of losing a credit card while they're traveling?
A couple of different things. I have two suggestions here. The first of which is I suggest that you travel with at least two credit cards. And for that just very reason, if one of them is compromised or even frozen, which can sometimes happen, then at least you have another card to be able to get by in the meantime. So to that end, never keep all of your cards in one place, because if you keep all your cards in your wallet and then your wallet is stolen, then you have no cards and no way to get by in the meantime. So take more than one card. So take at least two credit cards and one debit card. That's how I roll. And then also make sure that at least one of those cards is in a completely separate pocket of even a different bag entirely. But also it's very important to prepare for the possibility that you might have to deal with something like this on the road by storing copies of the information that's on your cards that you're bringing. So this would include not only the card numbers, front and back, ideally even photos of the card front and back, but also things like the phone number for your bank. So you have that easily on hand and can call them if there's a complication, like your card being frozen or if your card is actually stolen or compromised.
So where does that information live for you? Because I can imagine some people would put it on their phone. Amazing. But if their purse gets stolen, the cards go and the phone goes too.
You read my mind, Bruce, because there's a lot of different ways people store this information. Physical copies are okay, but they're only as good as where it is you're storing those copies in case they're lost or stolen. A lot of people like to take this information and email it to themselves. I personally have a problem with this because email is notoriously insecure. So if someone cracks your email, they've now got all of your information. So personally, I use a password manager. This encrypts and stores not only all of my passwords in general, but I also keep copies of my ID and credit cards, bank phone numbers, and everything else that I could need. It's way more secure than keeping it in an inbox. I could go on about password manager programs. Mm. They're fantastic. I did have my purse stolen many years ago when I was in Peru. I had one of these password manager programs, and within a few hours, I had called all the banks, canceled all the cards, and had replacement cards on the way by virtue of the fact that I had all this information stored, prepared, handy, and ready for such an event.
You talk about a VPN. What are the benefits of a VPN when it comes to financial risk?
Airports, hotels, and coffee shops are like playgrounds for hackers. And if you're not masking your internet activities with a VPN, then anyone who has ever been on that Wi-Fi connection, even if it has a password, who knows what they're doing, can technically access your information. So when you are in any kind of public Wi-Fi, and this goes for travel and at home, but like I say, airports, hotels, and coffee shops are playgrounds for these sorts of scenarios, make sure you turn on a VPN. What that will do is it will mask your IP address so you are not seen as being on that network by anyone who is accessing this network and knows how to get through those back channels.
It's like a cloak of invisibility.
It is. It's like the Harry Potter of financial security while traveling.
What's an anti-theft bag?
I am personally a big fan of using anti-theft gear. And there are a few companies out there that specialize in making these kinds of things, like PackSafe and Travelon. And you can get purses, slings, backpacks, luggage, and more. And what makes them anti-theft are the ingenious features that are built into them that will deter petty theft and crimes of opportunity. So these features include things like slash-proof straps, slash-proof material, an ability to actually take your strap and wrap it around a fixed object and lock it, and zippers that will lock together, or little features that will, in some cases, if they're not like bomb-proof, you can't lock it beyond any, you know, chance of having something stolen, but it can be just enough to deter the normal crimes that you're going to find when you travel, which are crimes of opportunity. If there's a bag, if you're at a restaurant and you have your bag sitting at your foot and it's not secured in any way, then someone might be able to take that. Unless you're protecting yourself, you have the proper anti-theft bags, and you've made sure that you keep your valuables close to you.
I think it is fair to say everyone, almost everyone, travels with a phone these days. For sure, it should be password protected, hopefully with Face ID or something quite complicated. What other more advanced tips would you recommend to set up your phone so your information isn't compromised if it is lost or stolen?
It's a great question, because more and more we are keeping all of our information on our phones. In the recent years, I've been kind of late to the game with regards to having information on my phones, like banking apps and credit card apps and whatnot, because I've been worried about financial security. But I realized in so many ways, not only is it more convenient, but it can be more secure if you put a few measures in place. So the first thing to do is to make sure that any app that you have that is financial in nature has two-factor authentication put in there, so it's difficult for anyone to log in. But also then secure your phone in general by creating a PIN required to access your or unlock your phone, and also set up a remote erase feature. And that's something that you can access from your laptop or tablet that will actually erase your phone in case it's stolen. So when you put all of this together, you will maximize the amount of security that your phone has. But then also too, I mean, just in terms of using day-to-day going around with your phone, be cognizant of the areas and neighborhoods where, if you're visiting a country where there's a financial disparity, make sure that you aren't overtly walking around with your phone in such a way that someone might be able to take it from you.
I consider myself to be really good at this stuff, and I realize I have a lot of things I now need to do before I travel again. So for that, I am grateful. Nora, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bruce. It is a great pleasure. I could go on and on about this kind of stuff. Sure. I like love nerding out on it.
Of course you do. Nora Dunn is the terrifier in chief at NerdWallet. She's their financial expert. She's a digital nomad. I'm teasing. Well, my blood pressure is elevated. I know exactly what I need to do. I made notes. I will take the next steps. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, a digital real estate platform called Wahi. We're going to talk to the company's CEO, Benji Katchen. I'm the money columnist for CityLine, which is a daily lifestyle show. It airs across North America. If you go to cityline.tv, you can find a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I would say I'm interesting. What's even more interesting is the Daily Dish. They do extraordinary segments on food. So basically, I'm just promoting their food columnists.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Selling your home is an expensive proposition, given the commissions that realtors earn. You don't really think about it like the price of a car because you don't pay it in that way, but it's a significant chunk of change. In fact, it probably is worth the price of a car. Over the years, there have been many, many companies who've been trying to kind of break up or disrupt this traditional system. There's Property Guys, there's Comfrey, there's been a bunch. And in other parts of the world, companies like that have done very well. We're going to talk about another digital real estate platform. It is called Wahi. Its CEO, Benji Katchen, is here to talk more about it, how it works, and what they are hoping to achieve. Hello, Benji.
Hello, how are you?
How does Wahi work?
Well, Wahi is a new digital real estate company, and it uses state-of-the-art tools, data, and experiences, really from a consumer-first perspective, to improve it for consumers, but also for realtors.
Give me an example.
So, for example, we provide the most up-to-date localized data, and we offer really a digital first approach to put consumers in control of every step of their home buying journey. So for example, if you're searching for a neighborhood, we have tons of data for 400 neighborhoods in the GTA to help people choose where they might want to live. If you already know where you want to live and you want to search and browse, we have the best search and browse experience to find that house, condo, townhouse that you're looking for. We also have a whole suite of alert features so that you can have an advantage the minute something hits the market that exactly fits your criteria. And the best part of all of this is you can set all of this up yourself on the comfort of your phone or your laptop to really take control of the journey yourself.
How do you make money?
We do make money through the commissions by helping people buy or sell houses. However, because we're able to put consumers more in control, we're able to charge significantly less than what the typical real estate commission is. I mean, you mentioned that it could cost as much as a car. That's no joke. In the GTA, where the typical house is, say, $1 million, there's $50,000 of real estate commission being paid, which is not just a car, it's actually a nice car. We're able to discount that substantially to consumers.
What role does a traditional realtor play in your model? So I'm going to polarize, just to make an example, is if you go with one of those other sites that I mentioned, you do it yourself. You become the realtor, you host your open house. How does it work with Wahi?
No, with Wahi, yes, you have excellent data, and yes, you have amazing information and tools at your fingertips, but you also have the best expertise helping you and guiding you every step of the way. The difference is what we've all learned in a post-Zoom world or post-pandemic world where we can all use Zoom is you don't necessarily have to have these professionals driving around all over the city just to help you buy your house. And that's not to say that place isn't important with real estate. However, the people that help you, and we have our own in-house realtors, we are a realty firm, they're able to do it much more effectively with the information and tools that we give for them to help consumers. And they're also able to be much more efficient with their time because they're not out running around, driving around the city all day long.
Commissions differ across this country. We're a national show. What you pay in Alberta is different than what you would pay, say, in Ontario, for example. But put this into terms that people can understand. What is an average commission that that one would pay? What would be the average commission that one would pay through Wahi?
So the typical commission I mentioned on a $1 million house or in the GTA, for example, if we use that as an example, it's 5%. There's an illusion that buyers don't pay commission because in Canada, typically the seller pays the commission. They pay 5%. Half of that goes to the selling agent, which is about $25,000. However, the notion that the buyer doesn't pay, in my opinion, is simply false because what happens is the seller agent then transfers another $25,000 to the buyer agent. So in essence, it's costing both the seller and the buyer, creating a big spread or a gap between what the buyer's paying and what the seller's receiving for that house. If you buy with Wahi, we take that $25,000 commission that we earn, but we typically give 70% of it back to the buyer. So on average, that's about $20,000 that we're returning to a buyer. And we all know that when, you know, you're buying a house, that's one of the most expensive times in your life. It's one of the times that folks are most financially stretched. And having an extra $20,000 to be able to help either buy furniture or moving costs or all those other expenses with a bit of redecorating or whatever it is that you need when you're moving to a house, I think is the difference between make or break for many people buying in this market.
One of the reasons I would assert that there has been so little innovation in this space, really for generations, is because the dollar value of these decisions is so massive. This is by far the biggest asset most of us will ever have. How do you reassure clients that your process is going to yield for the seller, yield the very best possible price, and for the buyer, the lowest possible price?
In my opinion, what's changed in all this time, you said that the industry hasn't really changed, and to a certain extent, that's correct. But technology has changed. And one of the things that we're able to do is we're able to liberate information to the consumer, whether that's a buyer, a seller, an agent, whoever that is, we're able to liberate information. So for example, you talk about price. One of the things that we've developed is a machine learning model that is the most accurate estimation of what houses are worth up to the minute in the GTA. We track 400 neighborhoods. We track four different dwelling types. We're tracking every single house that's selling. And up to the minute, we have a proven 90% accuracy rate with our WAHI Bestimator tool that estimates what this is worth. So there's a notion of what is fair value. And when you're selling, if you sell with WAHI, of course, you get the full exposure of MLS. In addition, we have an auction tool that consumers can use that opens up the sales process much more widely, even than MLS, with completely transparent bidding. And that's what will assure both the buyer and seller, if it's transparent, that everybody is getting the best or the fairest price for this. If you're a buyer, you can use our tools to estimate value. We have several other tools on our site. And at the end of the day, it's what's a fair price for a property.
The real estate market is very local and it can change on a dime. So you could sell a house one day and next door put the exact same house on the market and see a significantly different price because of rising interest rates or other some such things. How do you stay to the moment, to the minute on what a home is worth given how quickly things are moving these days?
Our data is updated every 15 minutes. So it's almost instantaneous. So as properties sell, they get entered into our machine learning model and we're completely on top of it. Another tool that we offer is called our Market Pulse tool. So the Market Pulse tool looks at 400 unique neighborhoods in the GTA, and we're looking at what bidders are bidding versus asking price up to the minute on a rolling 30-day basis. Bruce, I think you can't really get more recent than that in terms of the recency of the stats that we're looking at. So we really help people stay up to the minute with the recency of our stats.
You've got an auction model. How does that differ from other real estate auction companies?
I'm only aware of a couple of real estate auction companies, but and I can't really speak to them. But what I would say about ours is it's very much like eBay. I think customers are very accustomed to using auctions in other parts of their life. eBay would be probably the best example of a transparent auction model. We built our own auction model from the ground. It allows sellers a certain degree of control in that they can control the reserve price that they're listing their house at. Of course, if the reserve price is way out of whack, it doesn't make sense to go through the process. And that's why we use our Bestimate to sort of help guide where would we set a reserve price. A reserve price means the minimum price that they'd be willing to sell it for. And then we take all of the traditional photos and floor plans and home inspection and everything you would have in a typical listing. We put it on MLS. And after several days of showings, if the seller prefers to sell via auction, we list the auction and we give buyers 48 hours to bid on the property. We pre-qualify them to make sure that they're serious bidders. And we run a transparent auction where everybody can see what's happening with the pricing. It's very different than the typical closed offer presentment process where nobody really knows what's going on other than the number of offers presented.
It reminds me of how they do it in Australia, right? Where everybody stands on the front lawn of the home for sale and waves a little sign. I love it.
Absolutely. We've just invented the 2022 front lawn because it's all digital.
2022 front lawn. Benji, I'm afraid that's all the time that we have, but I really appreciate you joining us to talk about WAHI.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Bruce.
Benji Katchen is the CEO of Wahi. It is a digital real estate platform. And I'm going to keep my eyes on this. I've been talking about a lot of these kinds of organizations over the last 10 or 15 years. And we'll see what they can do to shake things up a little bit. Well, that is our show for today. A big thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you want to send us a note, so you want to ask a question, you want to give some feedback, you want to be reminded of a story that we did on today's show, or you've got a new one that you want us to cover, ask@moolala.ca is our email address. ask@moolala.ca. Reminder, you can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. On social media, I'm Bruce Celery, at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.